Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Listen, Dad, you can let me off right here, advised 14-year-old Jeremy, climbing out of the car about a block from school. That way no one has to see you. Contrary to Jeremy's wishes, we parents need to see and be seen in our children's schools, though not necessarily standing next to our teenagers. From their first day of kindergarten to their last day of senior year, our involvement and understanding of what goes on in our kids' school is important. From a parent's perspective, what do we need to know to help make our children's years in school productive? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We are fortunate today to have with us two bona fide experts, both of whom have had experience as parents and as heads of schools. Dr. Arnold Cohen is the head of Green Acres School, an independent school in Rockville, Maryland, serving grades pre-kindergarten through 8. He is the father of two grown daughters. We're glad to have you with us, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mrs. Kathy Gemberling is currently Deputy Superintendent of Schools for Montgomery County, Maryland. She has been principal of two junior high schools and a high school. She has a college-age son. Welcome, Mrs. Gemberling.
My pleasure to be here.
We'd like to ask you both, what enables a child to succeed in school?
No one thing. Everything coming together is what really enables a child to truly succeed, and it does begin at home with the parent. The attitude that a child brings to school, an expectation for success as opposed to an expectation for failure, and then having that expectation reinforced when they reach that schoolhouse and having the classroom be an inviting environment and one in which each child is able to grow and learn according to the most challenging expectations for the individual.
And I think that you've hit on two areas that I would have emphasized as well. Parents that encourage and support their children at home, and in general, children who are engaged in a curriculum which is developmentally appropriate for them and is full of wonder so that they're involved in what they do and construct knowledge through that curriculum every day that they go to school.
So it's comfort at home and comfort when they get there.
Yes, and I think if there's a lack of comfort, it's an excitement discomfort as opposed to a fear discomfort. And so that element of excitement is what really does engage a child in education.
Okay. We touched on this a little bit just now, but maybe we can expand on it a little bit more. Dr. Cohen, what can parents do to help a child have a productive school experience?
Parents can do a number of things. First of all, they need to be positive with their children and set high expectations for them. But when they do set high expectations for them, they should also rejoice in all the small successes children have on a daily basis. Parents also should really learn as much as they can about their own child's learning styles and their learning needs and to be sure that those are addressed in the school.
How do they know what their child's learning style is?
Well, there are a number of different ways. One way would be to observe a child, see what kinds of things they like to do and how they sort of spontaneously go about playing and learning. If you need more formal ways to do that, there are professional assessments you can have done for your child's learning style and learning needs.
And I think from a parent's perspective, the simplest kind of observations parents take for granted, but when you know how it can affect your child's learning, it moves to a different element in terms of your thinking. For example, is your child the one who's more likely to go off in a corner and do reading in a quiet place? Is that where he's most comfortable? Is she more likely to want to talk about everything that went on and express a lot of things? And then there's the other one who just wants to work with their hands, and then the combinations. So those are the kinds of things you look for and make sure that it's going on in the classroom. And you find that out by asking, what did you do today?
And hope you get
and
an answer.
And hope that you get an answer instead of a grunt on the way to the refrigerator.
Dr. Cohen, how can parents decide what kind of school environment or program is most appropriate for their child?
Well, first of all, knowing your child, and that's what we've just been talking about. Mm-hmm. If your child likes to build and you want to see that the program at school encourages children to engage in a hands-on way in their learning, you should be able to research the school, whether that's a public or a private school. You can do that by, as Kathy said, asking questions of your child. But you can also talk to the guidance people at the school or to the admissions director at an independent school. Or you could talk to the principal at the school and try to research what the school offers to the children. What is its mission? What is its philosophy? What kinds of things go on in the classroom? and then see if those things are a good match between your child and the school.
Would you advocate visiting during a school day when you can sort of eyeball what's going on?
I think, contrary to some of the traditional belief, the option of visiting a school is a very important one for a parent. Now, you have to be realistic about your expectations for a visit. If you walk in unannounced with no appointment, you can't be aggravated if there's not someone immediately available to give you a tour. On the other hand, if you come in and you say, I'm considering moving into this neighborhood and my child would be attending this school and I would like to have an opportunity to visit, I don't know of any school who won't make an arrangement either through the guidance department or through the administrative offices to give you a tour of the facility, answer your questions. There are published materials available in the school that give you data about the school. That same information is available in public libraries, and you can have an opportunity to visit. I always encourage parents to visit.
And in an independent school, of course, the director of admission would be there to help you visit a school, and independent schools are there to show you what they have to offer you, so they would encourage you to visit with them. So that would be in the private sector, that would be an easy thing to do.
Mrs. Gambling, what are the advantages and disadvantages of what we've been taught to call homogeneous grouping or tracking? And I guess there are two different discussions. One is for individual subjects and another one is for whole grades.
Right. Well, you know, this is the eternal educational debate. I'll give you my personal bias, and I accept quite freely that that's what it is. I am totally opposed to whole grade tracking. I think that that sets lock-in expectations for students, and that is counter totally to reaching the individual child. And I believe the best education focuses on individual children as opposed to what group should you be with. I do believe that in terms of just efficiencies of instructional delivery models, small groups that are somewhat homogeneous in terms of the instruction that they're working on at the time. It might be a reading group. There may be a different group for math. There may be a different group for foreign language, for physical education, whatever. But mixing students and having them have experiences with a variety of students helps them recreate their own sense of who they are. If you put them into a constant tracking level, you reinforce the idea of where I am is a matter of where they placed me, not what I can learn. And that's the opposite message you want to send a child.
The other thing, too, is that children who have an opportunity to move back and forth from one group to another, they have an opportunity to have more interaction with different people and children and teachers. And so they are able to appreciate what each of those can offer to them. And all of us live in untracked lives as adults.
Absolutely. I also think that a child's interests and ability changes throughout a school year, a school month even. So to think that they would learn at exactly the same pace is just not realistic, and it's not appropriate.
What do you say to parents who say, now my kid is really excellent in whatever the subject happens to be.
Right.
How can we keep stimulating him if he's not going to be in the top group?
And that's a classic. I mean, when you talk about who wants grouping, it is the parent who perceives his or her child to be always going to be in a top group. The best experience in the way I used to do to fix that, I don't care who the child is, there's always some kind of grouping you can find where they don't happen to be the best at that particular activity. And when they experience the idea of being at different levels and working up and moving to different levels, then their idea of always having to be in a fixed location in the pecking order is quite different. I do believe that if you are not careful in a heterogeneous class, that is where you do regrouping, if you don't challenge the top student, that is the parent who will come to you and say, we should have grouping. The issue is you challenge each student.
Mrs. Gamberling, how are class size and teacher-student ratio important?
If your classes are too large, your capacity to do that becomes diminished quite quickly. I will also say that just having small classes doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to reach the individual child. Because if you teach a small class as if you were teaching a lecture hall of 400, then you haven't gained anything at all by the small ratio. The reason for the small ratio is to enable the teacher to have a lot of different strategies and interact with each child and make sure that they have learned the material, and if they haven't learned it through that strategy, to be able to offer an alternate. And that takes small ratios.
But I would say that there's also diminishing returns after a certain point. When you get down to say 12 or 10 children in the classroom, what you then start to miss is the interaction between the children, and children can learn a great deal from other children in the class. So small classes are great as long as the teacher is working individually with different children, but you have to have enough of a core of children so that they can also interact with one another, and they're learning things outside of the academic. They're learning those social and emotional interactions with other people, and they have to have that number of children in the classroom in order to have those interactions.
How have you seen things like taking a kid who's very good in whatever it is and saying, here, why don't you work with another kid and help him to learn? Is that a valuable kind of thing for teachers to encourage, or are there some pitfalls in that?
I think if you just do it rather generally, as you just did, here, why don't you go help the student learn, it's probably not going to be very productive. We do find that, and the term cooperative learning is one that you hear used a lot, but basically shared action and activities in learning is good for students. And what you do is you do learn from each other. A student who understands something understands it much better if they are explaining it to a fellow classmate. And again, each person learns differently. That was the discussion where we began, watching your child. And interacting with one another is one of the most effective ways, one of the most effective ways to learn. Just sitting and receiving it from an adult standing in front of the room doesn't do it for most kids.
And it also teaches children to appreciate, again, what other children can offer. I once had a child who was a dysgraphic child who literally could not write. And yet, she was able to ask brilliant questions, was a great thinker, and was a terrific artist. So if you put her in a group and ask her to be the person who was the scribe in a group, it would have been a disaster. But the other kids often asked for her because she could produce wonderfully artistic creations that would go along with what somebody else would write, and she was able to ask good questions and to integrate a lot of the information verbally. But when you gave her the paper and pencil, it became a crisis. And so you have to learn to appreciate what each can offer. So in that case, it not only taught the kids to appreciate the subject matter in it from a different perspective, but it taught them to appreciate another child for what she could offer that group.
It's also much more realistic about life. I mean, how many people really work in total isolation from their colleagues and in competition constantly with their colleagues, which is kind of the traditional classroom setup. And instead, what you do is you share and you both learn and you both grow, and the group becomes more effective as a result. That's what the world's like beyond school, so that's what it should be in school.
Exactly, Kathy. In teams of people in industry and in research organizations are all working together for common goals, and it really is the post-industrial model that we're working with now.
The collective IQ.
Mrs. Gamberling, some schools or school districts are cutting back on certain subject areas because of budget constraints. What should parents beware of in this regard? What things should they consider non-negotiable?
Cutting back budget altogether is non-negotiable. I think that parents really do have to be an enormous advocate, not just for their own children, but for children in general. If what you're depending upon is the parent to support the budget, then you're unrealistic in terms of how you're going to make your financial impact. The important thing for all of us to understand is that a good education is the investment in the future. And if that child doesn't become a productive member of society when it is our turn to depend on that individual, we'll be let down. And so being able to really advocate for budgets in general is every community member's responsibility. From a parent standpoint, the things that you begin to watch, first of all, are general reductions of per pupil expenditure, looking at not just did they get the same budget they got last year, but does that budget reflect inflation and all of the other kinds of costs that are going. The next thing is, how's the money spent? And knowing what portion of that budget goes directly to deliver instruction in a classroom is the most important thing a parent can know. Some of the keys when you see that it isn't happening, you can watch for are certain programs cut out that were once in your school. The first thing that they usually cut out are the, quote, frills, the arts. That's a classic way to know that your school system is short on money. I'm not suggesting that arts are more important than the academics. But if the arts can go, the only place you can go to reduce money the next time is the academics. So the first key is to watch and see, is there a full complement of programs at the school? If so, it's probably a fairly healthy financial resource base.
Dr. Cohen, if you could change one thing about children's school experiences, what would it be?
I think I would change some things about the way in which we look at curriculum in schools. So often in many schools, the operative word is coverage. We have to cover so much of the curriculum in any given school year. And I think, unfortunately, what that does is I use a metaphor a little bit, a naval metaphor, the skimmers and the submarines. I believe that oftentimes, unfortunately, what happens is that teachers feel a need to get through the material, so they skim across it, not being sure that everybody understands in depth what children need to understand. But I believe that if we were a little bit more like submarines and we took certain topics and we researched them in depth, whether we did it individually or as a group and we spent more time, we could learn a lot of different things from any individual subject. So I would hope that children would be able to be engaged more fully in each piece of their learning rather than rush through the curriculum in a year. I think children would find that a more interesting, exciting experience.
Quite simply, if I could change anything, what I would want is that every time you ask a student about school, their response is, "I just love it." I think that there is not enough sheer love of education and learning. And I think that when children experience success, they do love it. When they experience failure or boredom, then they begin to see it as a drudge and a thing they have to do and a place they have to go. And then it ceases to be as effective.
Well, it's a shame that so much time is spent in a place that has so significant an impact on self-image.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't always come out the best.
I guess I'm feeling pretty lucky. I'm sitting here thinking that I don't have that happen to me too often. I've actually had students call me on snow days and say, "Please don't close schools."
So, oh, my gosh.
That's the kind of response you'd like to have. You'd like to have that everywhere, I think.
And I think we do have it many places.
Absolutely.
I think that the uniformity of it, and frankly, I think much of it, going back to, since this is a parent's perspective, how many parents send their students off to school saying, "You know, I loved school," and giving the message, "When I was a student, it was the best time of my life." It doesn't always happen. So sometimes they bring their perceptions with them.
Right.
Good point for the parents.
This is to both of you. During your careers as heads of schools, what have been the most helpful ways that parents have been involved?
I think the most helpful way is when the parents see themselves as partners with the schools and with the teachers. That doesn't mean parents shouldn't ask hard questions, because there are lots of times when hard questions are the best way to be a partner. But it does mean that parents also need to listen to the schools and to listen to their recommendations about their individual child, and to act on them when they hear them from the schools. But I think the most important thing is that if parents can be engaged with the institution, partners with that institution, and positive about the children's educational experience, rather than seeing themselves in some ways, even if they see themselves as advocates, not to see themselves as adversaries with the school.
I think the most important thing is for the parent to be knowledgeable and involved in the individual student's education. I think so often we define parent involvement as, do you volunteer at school? That is certainly a plus, and we have hundreds and thousands of volunteer hours in our schools, and it does help. But from a parent's perspective, if you're going to volunteer in the school, treat that as something separate from parent involvement in your child's education. They are two different things. One is a community member involvement. But as a parent, you should separate the two. Too often, the parent volunteer then wants to talk about the child and mixes the two, and that can make it difficult for teachers and others in the institution. Most important thing is knowing day to day what your child is learning, what they're involved in the classroom, and how to get that information. One of the things I always told parents was never ask your student, as I did, I think, earlier in the show, what did you do today? Because their answer is nothing. So your question is, what was the most exciting thing you did today? And make them respond. What was the most difficult thing you did today? And get a response. And then you clue in from there.
A little more specific than how was your day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mrs. Gemberling, what should parents understand about standardized testing?
Another one.
Is that another
issues?
Show? Do we have a separate show for that one? Standardized testing, I think, is defined in a lot of different ways. And so right away, I'm not sure that we have a uniform definition of that. But if we say standardized testing means that all students are basically taking a same kind of test for measuring progress, there are different kinds, and you should know which type standardized test your child is taking. Is it what's called a norm reference test, where the scale is set basically along the old traditional bell curve and along an expectation of so many students will be very successful and so many students will be failures and so many will be in between? Is it what's called a criterion reference test, where there are actual measures of information you're supposed to know? It's clear ahead what will be tested, and then the measure is, did the student master that particular piece of information? And in those tests, every student can potentially succeed, or every student could potentially fail, because it's based on specific information as opposed to comparison. One compares students against student, another compares each student against a standard, and that's what you want to know when you're looking at the test results.
Parents with children born at the end of a birth year for their entry grade will often hold them back to a younger grade. When do you feel this procedure is appropriate?
Ultimately, the school will make a recommendation. If the parent truly disagrees, I think that you can go along with the parent on the understanding, and I have said this to many a parent myself as a principal, this is not our recommendation, but no one knows your child better than you do. We will try it your way on the understanding that you realize it was your decision and not our recommendation, and we'll give it a chance. And, you know, my experience is that more often than not, the parent is right.
Special thanks to Dr. Arnold Cohen and Mrs. Catherine Gemberling for your suggestions and insights. A lot of parents will appreciate your help today. We have a gift for caller number 4 on our listeners poll, an autographed copy of Dr. T. Barry Brazelton's book for children, Going to the Doctor. To answer today's question coming up next, please call us at 1-800-791-8573 and tell us your response. What has been the most difficult school-related problem you have dealt with, and how was it resolved?
To answer, call us at 1-800-791-8573. We'd like to send you Dr. Brazelton's book this week and to use some of your comments on the air. So please leave your name and telephone number if you would like us to call you back. You can also reach us by email at parentspurr@aol.com or through your local station. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.